The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. Today, I want to revisit an issue that we've talked about on quite a few podcasts before, which is, I think, still percolating and still really one of the foremost issues of the time, which is reproductive freedom. Obviously, the Dobbs decision it was a major kind of defeat for that. But amid the decision, there were these sort of consoling liberal voices saying, well, we don't need to worry so much. Like, obviously, the red states will be bad, but, you know, we'll have in the blue states, things will be protected. And also, even in the red states, there'll be like abortion pills. And I think some of that sort of consoling language didn't, you know, come to terms with the reality of the anti-choice movement in the United States, which is very radical. Which did a very radical thing in, like, you know, in its sort of 50-year effort to change the nature of the Supreme Court and to overturn Roe v. Wade, which was, I would remind listeners, like a law that had been supported by 7 out of 9 Supreme Court justices when it was made. And then later, the essential right to choice was supported by another decision, Casey, in the early 1990s. And so to like overturn 2 Supreme Court decisions, made is a very radical thing. But a movement that did that is not going to stop with a sort of, you know, patchwork federalist solution. Their goal is to end reproductive freedom, and they will do whatever they can. And I think in this sort of recent months, we've seen the kind of emergence of legal warfare as a primary tactic on a number of fronts to really create an atmosphere where it's not just in red states, but in blue states, and in not just the sort of medical abortions, but even, you know, the access to pills that facilitate abortions that are being limited. It's a really radical movement. And I think one of the best people that's sort of been tracking this is Guardian columnist Moira Donegan, who I'm very happy to have on again. She's a frequent guest. And I want to start with this sort of like Texas law or this Texas legal case that's happening that she recently wrote about in The Guardian, which I think has like all sorts of implications.
Yeah, thank you, Jeet, so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here. I wish it was a happier occasion, but I think you don't really invite me on when there's good news.
Well, in the future, but... I'll try. Like if,
we'll do our best. But yeah, I wrote last week about a court case out of Amarillo, Texas. It's a federal court case where a group of anti-abortion sort of associations nominally associated with doctors are suing the FDA, saying that the FDA improperly approved a drug that is used in the majority of American abortions called mifepristone. Mifepristone has been approved by the FDA for about 20 years. It was approved in over 20 years. It was approved in 2000. So this is a bit of a tardy lawsuit. It was actually kind of its adoption in the U.S. was delayed largely for political reasons. It was originally developed in France in the 1980s, and it works by blocking the hormone progesterone, which causes a pregnancy to stop developing, and used in tandem with another drug called misoprostol, which causes contractions. It is incredibly safe and effective in terminating pregnancies. It is approved in the US, I believe, up to 10 weeks by the FDA. The World Health Organization approves it up to 12. Functionally, we know that it is used much later in pregnancy than that, with great effectiveness. It's profoundly safe, and it really revolutionized abortion care around the world because it does not require surgical intervention through the cervix, as most abortion techniques do. And, you know, the thing about abortion pills is that they can be taken in the privacy of your home. You can miscarry at home on your own time, and you can not tell anybody if you don't have to. And, you know, these drugs, their aftermath is medically indistinguishable from a miscarriage. If you have to go to the emergency room, most people don't, but some people do. Often because they are afraid that they're bleeding too much. But if you do wind up in an emergency room after having taken these pills, if you don't tell your medical providers that you took this medication, they can't tell. So it is, largely undetectable, incredibly effective, incredibly safe. And the anti-abortion movement absolutely fucking hates it because it has made particularly illegal abortions a lot safer. So up in the lead up to Dobbs, particularly especially after the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett in 2020, you really saw this shift in messaging from the pro-choice movement, groups like Planned Parenthood, now National Abortion Federation, National Network of Abortion Funds. They really leaned off of what had been for decades their primary message, which was the coat hanger, this threat that if abortions were not legal, women would resort to illegal surgical methods, such as like trying to penetrate their cervix and pierce the amniotic sac with long, sharp objects, which are incredibly dangerous. You cannot perform a surgical abortion on yourself. You cannot safely perform a surgical abortion if you don't know what you're doing. And we do know that before Roe, many, many women suffered, died, were maimed, were hurt in ways that they never recovered from these kinds of surgical illegal abortions performed unsafely and incompetently. But the medication abortion revolution really changed what an illegal abortion looked like. Suddenly, an illegal abortion didn't need to be a back alley procedure that you paid a quack doctor for, that you were extorted for, that you had to put on a blindfold and get into the back of a stranger's car to get taken to. It could be something you ordered online, did safely at home with a medication that had a lower risk of serious side effects than Tylenol. So, particularly post Dobbs, there's been this shift in the pro-choice movement to talk about illegal abortions. Firstly, they don't call them that anymore. They call them self-managed, which is, nicer sounding. And they've really attempted to destigmatize these abortions, which are A, now a lot safer, and B, for more and more people, the only abortions available, right? And what you've also seen is a growing network of organizations and individuals who are sending these pills into states that have bans. You have some people prescribing them across state lines by telemedicine. You have some people prescribing them and sending them in from abroad. And you have some people like bringing them physically into states that have abortion bans to distribute to women in need there. And there is an attempt by the anti-choice movement to make that very, very legally dangerous. And this lawsuit is part of that effort. So the litigants in this lawsuit, they're a bunch of quack doctors, really. One of them is this guy who has been dedicating his career to try and create a reversal for abortion medication. And he tried to design a trial for this cockamamie regimen he had, where he was like, well, if mifepristone blocks progesterone, what if I just pump these patients full of tons and tons of progesterone? And he somehow got somebody to let him try this on human beings, and 25% of the patients in that trial had to be hospitalized. Like, these women almost died. They're not sending their best. He and his co litigants are claiming that mifepristone is medically risky for women. They're saying, we see women in our practice who come in and they've taken these pills and they're bleeding. And the fact is that like some women do wind up in the emergency room after taking abortion medication. It's usually not because they have a serious complication. Overwhelmingly, it's because they're scared. And they are, doing something that is illegal or quasi-legal, that is highly stigmatized, that they have had to do in secret because they are going to be stigmatized and often prosecuted if they tell anybody what they've done. And they don't want to die. Then they're bleeding a lot because you are inducing a miscarriage, and miscarriages mean bleeding a lot. And in most cases, you want those people to go to the hospital. Like, these are women who have entirely good, reasonable, self-preserving instincts, which is A, go to a hospital, and B, tell your medical providers what you took, right? And we have to, as the pro-choice movement, we have sort of have to message around that, say, maybe try not to go to the hospital. Maybe don't tell your medical providers everything, which is a horrible position that these patients have been put in because of the law. So, this lawsuit was brought. It's this like pretextual. It's not very honest. But they went forum shopping. So The thing about Amarillo, Texas, where this lawsuit is being heard, is that there is only one federal judge in that district. His name is Matthew Kismark. I think it's Matthew. His ju Judge Kismark. He's a Trump appointee. He's 45 years old. He's absolutely never going to die. And before he was appointed to the federal bench by Donald Trump, he had a job at a far-right litigation shop that routinely brought anti-abortion lawsuits. So this is his whole career. He recently ruled in favor of this like controlling Christian father who didn't want his daughters to be able to get birth control through federal Title 10 without his say so. So he also has limited teens' access to birth control pretty recently. And it's not really a question of whether or not this judge is going to rule in favor of the plaintiffs or not. He is. He is going to issue an injunction that will bar mifepristone from being recognized as fully approved by the FDA. Now, what that will mean in practice is still up in the air. He could issue a really maximalist opinion that removes mifepristone from the market nationally, which would create a crisis coast to coast in abortion care, not just in red states where abortion bans are in place, but also in blue states that are pretty protective of abortion. Or he could issue a more limited ruling that would bog the medication down in some, tedious bureaucratic bullshit, but wouldn't necessarily limit its availability. Here's my cat who's come into the Zoom. This is Mouse. She
Yes,
has very
listeners,
strong
you can,
opinions.
if you hear the meowing, that's neither more nor I, so that's the cat.
Mouse is also in favor of abortion access. So, the pro-choice movement and, the medical establishment is sort of waiting on bated breath to see whether or not this guy removed mifepristone from the market. And there were several ways that the pro-choice movement could respond, right? Some providers will likely only perform surgical abortions, which are a lot more invasive and a lot more resource intensive. So in these blue states, every clinic is absolutely slammed with out-of-state patients who are traveling, 2,000 miles, 500 miles to try and get an abortion someplace where they can legally get it. And these are clinics that are already have really high overhead. They're already dealing with harassment. They're often dealing with restrictive laws, even in relatively liberal states that make their own jobs way harder. And they just have way, way, way more patients than they can possibly accommodate, right? So needing to switch all of those to surgery abortions is going to create longer wait times, push treatment back in pregnancy, push a lot of people out of getting treatment at all. Some providers will switch to a regimen for medication abortions that only uses one of the two drugs. So mifepristone is fairly effective on its own, but the much more tried and true one drug abortion regimen is a misoprostol-only regimen, which is a kind of abortion that doesn't block progesterone before it induces contractions. It just induces contractions. You need more misoprostol. You need more time. It's a lot more painful, and it's a bit less effective. But you can do an abortion that way fairly safely. And, some people are going to be trafficking drugs into the country illegally, which is, already happening to some degree and is going to become the only option for medication abortion for more and more people. But the big risk when Kismark rules and potentially removes mifepristone from the market is that more women are going to, they're going to get desperate. They're going to go back to those illegal surgical methods that we know are so dangerous. So it's like the threat is the threat of the return to the coat hanger era.
No. So now I think some listeners might think, well, okay, let's say this crazy judge in Texas, the red state, makes this ruling, and even if he makes it there, there's like fallback positions legally, like in terms of, well, it'll be sent up to a higher court and might be overturned there, and perhaps some of the blue states can pass further laws to countermand that. Or I think that what we might have to address, though, is that this tactic of using the law is very effective, not just for what they can get the law to do, but how they can terrify people, that there's a kind of chilling effect, especially not so much with women seeking abortion as the sort of institutions around it, sort of doctors, insurance companies, pharmacies. There's a vast kind of infrastructure, and a lot of those places tend to be very cautious about the law. And I think that the anti-choice movement is very effective in saying, in using the uncertainty of the law. Like, they don't necessarily even have to get all their own way. If they can create a situation where the law is uncertain, then a lot of these very cautious institutions will not provide access to either abortion or to the sort of medicine that's relevant here. Do you want to talk a little bit about this? This real kind of like chilling effect, and the way that there's been a kind of very weaponization of the law that's really created almost, I would say, a constitutional crisis as to where legal authority resides.
Yeah, so you're pointing out something really important, especially in the post-Dobbs landscape, which is that the anti-choice movement is relying a lot on confusion, fear, and preemptive compliance, right? So doctors are not lawyers. I will say that every abortion provider I've ever met has, by a dint of the requirements of their job, become very, very versed in legal proceedings. But you also have a lot of situations where women are, in Tennessee, this is happening once a week now. You have a woman who comes in a medical emergency during pregnancy because she's developing preeclampsia, or because she has a blood clot, or, God knows what number of complications, and the treatment is a termination. But the doctors are now faced with the choice between, doing the medically right thing and protecting their patients and performing an abortion, which means committing a felony, or, allowing that patient to sicken further. And they're choosing the latter, because that seems safer to them. And they are unclear about what they're allowed to do. And these laws are written, frankly, in deliberately vague ways that sort of obfuscate the boundaries of legal and illegal conduct because they want to chill the maximum amount of conducts, right? And you said it's not necessarily about women seeking abortions that this conduct is where this conduct is being chilled, but that's actually not true. What you hear from abortion providers post-Dobbs all the time is that they will be in a state where abortion is legal, or they will be in a state where an abortion ban is currently enjoined by a judge. And they will have patients call assuming that abortion is illegal and assuming that they have to travel out of state, even if, in fact they don't. So there's confusion among patients, there's confusion among doctors. There's also a ton of sort of preemptive overcaution. These doctors, these clinics, hospitals, pharmacies, they all have legal boards which are advising them to take the maximally cautious, maximally self-protective stance, which is to deny all care that could endanger a fetus, even if that care is, necessary to a woman patient's health, life, or thriving, right? So you have issues like, for instance, Walgreens. So recently, the Biden administration is, sort of insufficient and tardy in their response to Dobbs. They're doing not very much, and they're really taking their time doing it. But they did try to, marginally increase access to abortion medications by directing their FDA to allow these to be distributed at normal pharmacies, right? So part of the politics around abortion medication is that for a long time you could only get it directly from a doctor. You couldn't get it from a retail pharmacy. No medical reason for that to be the case. It was purely a matter of making it harder to get. And the Biden administration, to their credit, moved to remove that, right? So suddenly, for a couple of days, it looked as if, in states where abortion was legal, these.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Medicines were going to be available for pickup at, you know, your corner pharmacy. And then the anti-abortion movement struck. You know, they threatened lawsuits. They threatened mass protests outside of like every retail Walgreens chain. Students for Life is, I think, still like protesting outside of Walgreens on like the first Saturday of every month. You know, it's like, it's silly shit, but it works. And Walgreens said that they would not be distributing mifepristone because they don't want that headache, but they also don't want to have to change their policy when the Biden administration leaves office. Suddenly there is a Republican-controlled FDA, a Republican-controlled Department of Justice, and now they're getting sued, right? And there's actually additional efforts by the anti-choice movement to sort of make this preemptive compliance with the anti-choice position before that position becomes law more and more appealing, right? So there is a theory, there's reporting out in Vox this morning about a theory being advanced by this lawyer named Jonathan Mitchell. I believe he was a Roberts clerk at one point, but he's most famous for being the guy who concocted Texas's SB8 scheme, which is basically an abortion ban, a pre-Roe 6-week abortion ban that was designed to evade judicial review. You may have heard the clip of Elena Kagan at that oral argument going, some geniuses came up with this scheme, and he's the some genius. This guy, Jonathan Mitchell, now is advancing a theory that actors who perform abortions or provide abortion medication or facilitate abortions in some way while an abortion ban is enjoined, so while it's been like suspended from enforcement by a judge, can actually be sued or even prosecuted when that ban goes back into effect for conduct that they performed while it was legal, right? So it's this sort of abortion becomes illegal even while it's illegal. Its illegality is sort of suspended in time, and it's like preemptive, right?
You can be like, the theory is that you can be retroactively punished for stuff that was like legal at the time, but exactly, later becomes illegal. It's just like, you know,
Right. And then, and that sort of, and, you know, this is part of Walgreens thinking, right? They're like, we're not going to do this legal thing because it might be illegal later, which does raise the question, as you mentioned earlier, like, who decides what the law is? Is it Joe Biden's FDA or is it Jonathan Mitchell's FDA? Like, who is the regulatory power? Because right now, de facto, the regulatory power is with this anti-choice movement. It's not with the federal government. The federal government has proven that it doesn't quite have the ability to enforce its own policy in practice, right? But the anti-choice movement does.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I think in a previous podcast with our mutual friend, Linda Hirschfriend, we had talked about the way in which the abortion issue, you know, parallels, you know, the great American struggle for freedom over slavery, in the sense that the slave, the issue of slavery really raised the issue of like where power resides. And the slavocrats were never going to be happy with a kind of federal solution where they could just have slaves and it would be illegal. You could have abolition elsewhere because slaves could run away. And so you kind of had this kind of situation where because this issue could not be localized, it had to become a national issue. And it had to, so, you know, you had things like the Fugitive Slave Law Act and, you know, various attempts. by the slaveocracy even before the Civil War to impose their will on the whole nation, to kind of like, you know, restrict freedom of speech in terms of like abolitionist literature, whether it should be allowed to go through the federal mail. So I think the, you know, there's a kind of striking parallel here with the abortion issue, that if you have the sort of anti-choice side is so fanatically committed to like imposing its will, that it will like, you know, try to use whatever levers of power to supersede authority. And it really becomes an issue of who rules, like who, you know, who decides ultimately. And I think, you know, like if we use return to the slavery analogy, I mean, like this is, you know, like Lincoln's great question, like, you know, is this something that we're going to let, you know, the courts decide, you know, like, in, will Justice Taney decide in Dred Scott? Or is this actually, you know, like if we're like a republic where the people rule, then, you know, like this is ultimately a democratic issue. And this might be like a good kind of place to, you know, draw out the larger politics of this, because I do think that we're heading towards a kind of battle over this fundamental issue of who rules, and that the anti-choice side has a certain amount of power in the courts, thanks to all the judges that Trump and before him Bush appointed. And, you know, like they dominate in the Supreme Court. But, you know, like, you know, as Lincoln said, and after him, Franklin Roosevelt said, you know, like the courts are not the final arbiter of this thing. This is a democracy and the people rule. And so it seems to me like the solution to a lot of this stuff and the fight that's coming has to be that, like, you know, the Democrats, as tardy as Joe Biden is, have to, like, you know, like take up this issue and, you know, push for a democratic resolution. So do you want to have some thoughts on that?
I mean, I agree with you. I'm always a little wary of using slavery as a metaphor. I tend to think chattel slavery just like fails as a metaphor, like chattel slavery in the Holocaust. Like by the time you're, you know, drawing those.
I know.
Sound like a quack, but you're not.
I should be clear. Like I'm not saying, like, equating the two struggles in terms of like saying that they're the same thing, except that in terms of American politics, like there is a way in which like these kind of fundamental issues about, like, you know, human rights and who rules can never be settled in the sort of patchwork way, and that ultimately it comes down to an issue of democratic control.
No, I absolutely agree, right? So like abortion is a question of, are we going to endow women with the full dignity of citizenship? Are we going to allow them to be adults with, you know, self-determination over their own lives, control over the course of what happens to their bodies. And, you know, these are questions that are fundamental to citizenship and have been fundamental to citizenship in the past in all kinds of ways, you know. And then there's also the question of, are we going to allow the majority to be ruled by the minority, right? So you do have issues now of red states trying to extend their statutory control beyond their borders. You have issues of, you know, popular will and popular sovereignty really being undermined and straight out undone by these unelected courts. So, you know, you have policy positions that are not being voted for being enforced upon people, you know, and there's a reason the anti-choice movement had to win through the unelected courts. It's because they could not win at the ballot box, right? And you can see, frankly, that they are undermining the democratic process in all kinds of ways, and undermining, you know, what we would think of as sort of routine healthy checks and balances procedures in all kinds of ways to try and keep abortion bans in place and to try and make sure that they're enforced. So you have states that are trying to prohibit ballot initiatives, trying to make abortion specifically immune from ballot initiatives, trying to raise the threshold by which ballot initiatives need to win, because all of these red states saw what happened in Michigan in November, where a ballot initiative on abortion rights not only won resoundingly, but drove Democrats to a like huge victory in that state, right? So they're trying to get rid of ballot initiatives. In Texas and some other places, you see state legislatures really trying to limit prosecutorial discretion, because in these urban areas to more democratic, more liberal leaning kind of cities in these red states. You'll have prosecutors, DAs running on, I will not prosecute abortion. And now these state legislators are threatening to, you know, fine and imprison these DAs for every abortion case that they don't charge, you know. And you have overall like an attempt to shift power to state houses and to federal courts, because that's where there is pretty robust Republican capture, right? And that is, you know, you can't exclude half the population from full political life without resistance. Like, that is, abortion already creates this instability, even if you could contain it, right? Like, it's it's not a supportable way of life. But also, you can't have these laws extending beyond their jurisdictions, these laws sort of negating the power of other officials, these laws sort of being suspended and enforced, not regard to popular will, not regard to like judicial procedure, but regard to like the threats of these thugs who are going to show up outside your Walgreens franchise if you don't do what they say. You know, it's really a threat broadly to the rule of law and to the constitutional order, as well as to our conceptions of what, you know, the dignity of citizenship should entail. So yeah, I don't think it's a sustainable enterprise. And by the way, neither do the anti-choice movement. You know, all this crap that they were pulling, I'm cursing a lot on this podcast, I apologize, but
no, it's like worded.
Do it
it's
on
worded.
The time of monsters. I feel like I can do it on the time of monsters, but you know, they were for decades had this charade that their opposition to Roe was a matter of states' rights, and as soon as Roe is gone, they're gunning for a national ban. They're gunning for, like, you know, coming for the FDA, trying to take away mifepristone in these states that that want access to it. So, you know, there's not not a ton of regard for popular sovereignty here, and also of course not a ton of regard for the individual sovereignty of women over their own lives.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think the lesson to kind of draw out is the anti-choice movement, you know, as emboldened and tries to really push its agenda, use the new Dobbs environment to push its agenda in a maximum way, is necessarily in conflict with democracy, because, you know, what they want is not popular. It's not popular, like, even in red states. And so they do have to use whatever democratic means that they have at their disposal. But I think that also points to, you know, like, where the maybe the solution or the remedy is. And this is why, you know, like, the Civil War analogy kind of falters here, because I think that there's actually a remedy that is, you know, far short of having to fight a civil war, which is, like, you know, use the actual democratic power of the federal government. That let's suppose the Democrats run in 2024 on you know, like, restoring Roe, or even going beyond Roe, like, really restoring a robust reproductive rights, and they go to the American people and say, you know, give us Congress, give us the House back, give us more in the Senate, give us the presidency, and we will, like, you know, enact laws to do this. And, you know, like, of course, a lot of people will say that, you know, a congressional solution only goes so far because the Republicans still have the courts. But then you can also have a battle over the courts, because there's ways in which Congress can limit the power of the courts to decide these things, and can, like, actually, like, you know, pare back that authority, and then also maybe actually change the nature of the courts, you know, like, by actually, you know, putting in judges that are not like this guy in Amarillo, you know. So it really becomes, so yeah, let's say the Democrats do take this and has this, like, put abortion at the forefront, but also link abortion with, you know, this larger issue of democracy, or this also equally large issue of democracy, which is also equally popular and had a real effect in the 2022 midterms. And just say, you know, we have these two very strong issues, abortion and democracy, they go hand in hand. you know, give us the power to do this. What do you think about that pitch?
Great idea. I don't know if Joe Biden will buy it. You know, like, I think you're right. Like, abortion and democracy, they are animating issues. They are, I think, in a lot of ways, you very clearly articulated, they're really the same issue. Mm-hmm. And it's about the dignity of citizenship. It's about self-rule. And Republicans are opposed to both. And, you know, this, as you mentioned, was a huge driving factor for Democratic victories and Republican underperformance in the midterms. Like, that was not supposed to even be a close election. And the Republicans could barely eke out a control of the House of Representatives, and it's such a narrow majority, and they're so divided and crazy that they're not able to function anything with it. And that's because of these two issues, abortion and democracy and self-rule, self-determination for individuals and for you know, the polity writ large. I think it's a winning issue. I think that the Democrats are still afraid of it, and I don't understand why. I don't know how much more data and experience they need to demonstrate to them that abortion is a politically winning issue. But, you know, these, we've talked about this before. I came on, I think, your podcast right after the midterms, and we talked about, you know, the Republicans have leaned so far into their base. They've leaned so far into culture war grievance, and it's creepy and it's isolating, and people don't like the vision of the future that they are putting forward of this, you know, regressive, narrow-minded, terrified, violent, you know, white world that Republicans want America to become. And I think that there is a way for Democrats to stop fighting the Republicans on the Republicans' own terms. Like, stop litigating about cancel culture. Stop, you know, trying to prove that you're adequately masculine to some, like, coal miner outside of Pittsburgh who you just made up in your mind, you know, like, or steel worker outside of Pittsburgh that you just made up in your mind. You know, this guy doesn't exist. Or if he does, he's not voting for you. You have to, you know, the Democrats really need to accept that their base is women. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of outside of the political strategic mind that is dominated in the Democratic Party. They're thinking very hard and almost obsessively about white working class men. But I think they need to, you know, think harder about what a message that would appeal to women voters would look like and be willing to pursue it. Because that's who's voting for them, and that's who they need to turn out.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think there might be a tension within the party. I mean, the party has different factions or elements, and there's a kind of sort of a consultant class that is very much, as you outlined, very obsessed with old fights and has a kind of vision of the electorate that's old. But, you know, within the Democratic Party as well, like, I think a lot of the victories in 2022 came from the fact that there are robust social movements, not least of which is the pro-choice movement, that are able to push the party to go much further. So, I do think that the sort of messaging that I outlined is unlikely under Joe Biden, but one can sort of foresee maybe in the future some virtue of the Democratic Party, like, making that argument. And I would want to suggest, like, I think it's an argument that has the merits of both being true and popular and likely to be successful. So I want to, you know, you were saying, like, I always have you on to have bad news, but I want to offer, like, the possibility of a utopian future.
Yeah, we always have to end on that note. And, you know, in fairness, some people are doing this. I'm thinking of Gretchen Whitmer, who did this very well in Michigan. She had the bump of the abortion referendum, which I think every Democrat running at the state level should do everything in their power to get an abortion referendum on your ballot, because that's how you win re-election. But, you know, there's always been kind of a needless divide in the Democratic, like, pundit and consultant class between people who advocate for, you know, economic issues and people who advocate for social issues. And they're not really substantively different. You know, that's old left thing or new left thinking that, you know, we need to move beyond, because it's not 1970 anymore. These are interlocking issues, and you can pitch them together. And in fact, I think you have to.
Yeah, no, that's also is a really excellent point, because I think that was also that is a major kind of stumbling block. So on this relative note of optimism, I want to thank once again Mara Donegan, frequent guest, and hopefully we'll be frequent returning guests in the future. Always, even when we're dealing with these dark subjects, very invigorating to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Jeet.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.